Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series, toughmantri.com, by VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, by Polar, blood, sweat, and data, Premium Plus Sports, official travel agency of Babbittville, our Swim Run USA sponsor. That's USASwimRun.com. If you haven't tried a swim run, grab a buddy and give a swim run a try. By our Challenged Athletes Foundation, this last year we sent out 2,806 grants, totaling $4.3 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on Babbittville on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here. Our next guest just won one of the hardest races on the planet. He is the Ultraman World Champion. His name is Richard Thompson. Richard, how the heck you doing?
Very good, Bob. Thank you so much for having me back on the show.
Well, it's my honor, after watching the craziness of a couple weeks ago. First of all, you've done how many Ironman races in your career?
I think I've done 15, I think, total. 15 or 16.
And so when you got into Ironman racing, and then there was a period after, I think after you won age group worlds in Kona, then you basically took time off and decided, you know what, I need to do something else. What got you back into triathlon?
I think I came back to watch a friend in Kona, and I hadn't been back to watch the race since I raced there and as an age grouper, and fortunately, I won that race.
Yeah.
Always, you know, I was coaching athletes, and always obviously kept a good eye on the race every October, but never had gone back there. And went back there to watch a friend, and he had a great race. I think he got fifth in the age group, and it sort of sparked I was 30 years old, and it sort of sparked a seed. I was planted another seed in my mind, and thinking, gee, I wonder as a mid 30 year old or an early 30 year old how fast I could race again. And that was enough to get me back. And obviously the goal was to come back to Kona. And if I knew what I could do as a 23-year-old, I wonder what I could do as a 30-year-old. That was it.
Well, and so you come back and do Ironman, but you also, a couple years ago, decide to, Ironman's not quite long enough. And it's just sort of it's sort of an appetizer. I think I'd like to do something a little longer. So the appeal of Ultraman, where you went to do Ultraman Australia, and we're talking a 10K swim followed by a 90-mile bike day one, 171-mile bike ride day two, and then a double marathon day three. And more importantly, you can't do this thing alone. You need to have a crew, and the relationship between the athlete and the crew is paramount to being successful. Mm-hmm. Was that the attraction of moving from Ironman to Ultraman, the whole idea of working with a crew, the whole idea of I want to go longer, I want to test my boundaries? What was it?
Yeah, I think it definitely reminded me of that anticipation that you get when you first step up to Ironman, where you're in uncharted territory. You have no idea whether you can actually do the distances again. And the crew thing is just so awesome. To be in a, I always sort of say that you need a really, really good, really, really good team around you to do Ironman very well. But once the gun goes, you're on your own, right? Like, you can have the supporters on the sidelines, but you've got to make all the decisions yourself, the pacing, nutrition, and everything. And that's the beautiful thing about Ultraman, is that you simply cannot do that race without a crew. And the crew is equally responsible and equally, responsible for the results as well. So as much as I love, you know, it's obviously wonderful to receive accolades and congratulations sort of messages, but I honestly feel about 20% of this is mine, and the rest of the crew each receive 20% as well, because without them, the result wouldn't have happened.
So you did, I think your time in Australia, 21-21, something along that line, was the fastest in history, the fastest Ultraman in history. And you win, and it's your first time out, right? And you come out, and it's not a bad debut. Go out, break the world record, win the race. Did you know at that point, okay, I want to go do the Worlds. That's why I'm here, to do Australia, but I want to go do the Worlds. Or was it, hey, I'm going to do one and see how it is?
I think that when we were going towards the prep for Australia, Worlds wasn't on the cards because I thought, oh, we'll see how this goes.
Sure.
Because there's so little literature out there for Ultraman in terms of how to train for it. So I didn't know. I mean, I felt fit, but I didn't know whether I was, how well this whole 3 day thing would go. And it panned out well. And as soon as, the world record was ridiculous, and I feel like, obviously, you could name 200 professional triathletes who would be faster, stronger, better than I am. But to have that just for a little while, and given the sports that are 34 years old as well, my immediate thought was, well, the history of this sport is in Hawaii. That's where majority of those 34 years have been raced. Amazing list of athletes who have raced in Hawaii for the Ultraman World Championship. Mm-hmm. So I would love to go there, race on the same course as them, and see how I stack up to my colleagues, but also to the overall time.
So when you went over this year to do a little scouting, correct?
Yeah. I've been now to Kona to watch Ironman maybe six times now, and had never really gone outside of the course, as most athletes do. So Ultraman changed the course substantially this year because of the volcano activity on the south of the island. So, which arguably made the riding a lot harder, a lot more demanding. So I went over in October to coach athletes for the Ironman World Championships, but spent maybe 4 or 5 days for myself to go over the course. Because Ultraman Australia, I live on the course, so we knew every single corner. But the concept of racing a completely different race, and obviously lots of different climates, and a much more technical course, much more climbing, much more descending. I think that was one of the most important parts of the preparation, was to go there and to see what the course had in store for us.
Well, and then when this thing kicks off, the worst thing that can happen to an athlete when they're swimming is to get sick and nauseous when you're basically, 4 miles from the finish of the swim, which is 6 miles is a ridiculous amount of distance to swim anyways. And you're talking, Daniela Reef got stung by a jellyfish during Kona. There's big fish out there. There's current. It is nice. It's like you're swimming in an aquarium. It's great. But when you get sick out there and you're a long way from the finish, what was going through your head? Because, again, you've got a crew. You're sort of responsible. You pull out half an hour into this 3-day event, right? And then all of a sudden it's like, hey, thanks. It was great coming over. But,
this is all over.
It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, massive. And I was I was confident with my swimming, and you obviously have your swim escort, so someone like a sort of kayak to swim next to you to take you through. And I had a great start, and it was probably halfway. It was that we'd gone really quickly. The currents were very favourable early on, and then I started to feel sick, and I've never experienced that in my life, and I've swum in a lot of choppy conditions, but I just got really disorientated and really, really quite dizzy, and I had to grab a hand onto the kayak and just sit there for, I think it was about 3 or 4 minutes, where I was just had to get my mind, try to get that sort of horizon to stay still. And Rob, who was the defending champion, he caught up and swam straight past me and into the distance. And the Sheridan was still a long, you could see the Sheridan, this is an exit. It's still a long way away.
And yep.
There was a little bit of a panic to think there's like 12 people that have come over from various parts of the world to support me. And what happens if I have to tell them the day, the race is over? So I was so fortunate that my local swim escort had a little bit of orange, you know, some orange in his bag, and he was like, "Do you want that?" And it's funny how the body, when it sort of needs something, it sort of grabs, you know, it jumps at it. And
right.
I looked at that and thought, that's exactly what I feel like, just some substance. And I had that, and maybe like 3 or 4 minutes later, that sort of settled my stomach, and I felt like it was just a bad dream. It just all came good. And at that stage, I think I was about 3 or 4 minutes behind Rob.
Yep.
But I didn't care. Like, no, I was just like, I'm just so stoked that I don't feel sick anymore.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And then, the tides changed, and it got the last maybe 2 mile was extremely slow for everyone. But as I said, that didn't bother me because I was just happy to be feeling a lot better.
Well, and then you get on the bike and you're, like you said, you're 3 minutes down. You basically end up with a 7 minute lead at the end of the day. So you put 10 minutes on Rob. That's got to give you some confidence. But you had gone out and scouted that course. You knew day two was going to be brutal.
Yeah, day two was crazy. You know, you're right on the Ironman course from Kona to or directly from Kona out to Waikoloa, and then you turn right and head up past the village, and then all the way up the saddle road to the top of the to the park at the top of the volcano.
Yep.
And which is about. Oh. I think I don't know how many feet that is, Bob.
Well, you climbed 13,700 feet, and from talking to a lot of folks, that first, basically, people were climbing for three straight hours.
Yeah, it was almost 2 hours of straight climbing, and I guess where that course is crazily difficult is that climb is relatively at the start of the race. You know, so you probably got an hour of riding, and then you get into it. And so the ramifications of the rest of your ride and then how that leads into the run is, you know, you're on a knife edge. You don't want to ride too hard for that climb because it's so easy to do that because you're feeling quite fresh. But you have to also understand there's still, you know, 100 mile of riding after that plus day three. So it was very, for us, we had to, I mean, I had that lead, but Rob and
Peter Vabrusek.
Yeah, correct. And David Hainish, they're all up the road ahead of me, you know, whether they were playing, you know, they were riding with their own plans as well. But I was being held back by my crew to make sure I rode to the plan that we had and to make sure that we had enough time or enough energy, rather, to ride that second half of that day two really well.
Well, and I talked to your crew a few different times, and they're like, we've told him, you know, keep the wide chest below. He can't go over this. He's got to stay there. And that's where that crew comes in, because they become your governor, right? They can keep you from going out of your comfort zone, even though you're a racer. You don't want anybody
in front
of you. You want to go catch those guys and drop them. Right?
Absolutely. And especially up that first climb where people come around you and you're like, oh, why are you coming around me? Like, I'm a strong rider. Like, you don't come around me. And then you just got to let that go. And absolutely. You know, the crew did an incredible job to hold me back like that. And I guess, the beauty of Ironman is that you've got to make your own decisions under significant duress, right? That is incredibly difficult to be able to compromise with your brain while your brain goes to mush in an Ironman, and you're still the governor, you're still in charge. Well, it's well to ran you outsource that and just say, all right, I'll just, you know, you guys are not fatigued, you guys have got the best interests of me, so I'll just do whatever you tell me. And that's what ends up transpired.
And it was really fun covering, because here you had, you know, the three of you, you and Rob Gray and Peter Vabrusek, and Peter's done, 190 Ironman races. This was his first time at this particular Ultraman. And Rob's defending champion, so you know you're with the right guys, and Hainish is a hell of a cyclist. So, you know, you guys are all sort of taking turns at the front and not so much working together, but it was you guys separated yourself fairly quickly from everybody else. And it was fun to watch on the backside of the island.
Yeah, it was funny, you know, going up the climb, you know, I think Peter had up to 4 minutes.
He did.
Hainish had 4 minutes up that, and Rob was somewhere in the middle, and I brought that back by the top, and I actually put about a minute lead into both, and I'm like, trying to go as quickly as I can down this descent. And again, it's like 45 minutes, but you're going, you know, maybe 50 miles an hour and or 40 miles an hour going down this volcano. And for so long, you just, you know, and I hadn't we said hello to Rob. I had a good chat to him a few days before, but otherwise you keep to ourselves and you race and race and race. And then we pulled up to this red light, this traffic light in Hilo, all three of us were like, how's it going?
Like you're just out for a ride. Yeah,
exactly. Having this chat like it's a weekend social ride, and there's a lot of traffic lights in Hilo, so we sort of made this decision that we'd just ride together, no one would get caught out at a traffic light, so we could get through that safely and without needing to sort of race, I guess. But yeah, it was. I was buoyed by the fact that how close that ride was on day two in terms of how. There wasn't a lot of time ever between any of us.
Right. And then, you know, for the listeners, this race, there's no roads blocked off. I mean, this is an open road, and you have to follow all the traffic rules. And you roll through a stop sign, you get and I think Rob went through a stop sign? Somebody went through a stop sign,
yeah,
got like a 6-minute.
And he got a 6-minute penalty. So it's incredibly crucial to obey, you know, the stop sign for sure. But, yeah, and so it's still a long way from Hilo back around to Harvey. So we just had to be patient, and I think Rob dropped off a little bit there. And,
yep.
I was surprised by Peter's strength. Again, absolutely no disrespect, but just the way they came back to me on the volcano, I thought their days were, you know, that they'd cooked themselves or otherwise, you know, dropped down a little bit of power. But he was really strong between Hilo and the climb up to Waimea, but it was just, and also, Bob, as you know, it was such an amazing day of weather. Like, it's so unlikely for that around that side of the island to be clear, and I think we got about 20 minutes of rain, but that was all. We were really lucky.
But last year, it was like it was the deluge for, almost like we had the plagues going on. And the nice thing from a safety perspective, I know people like riding the Kahalas, but man, the wind up there is just ridiculous. And I thought this was a safe, but again, 171 mile ride with 13,700 feet of climbing. You were on the bike, and there was a point where your crew basically took the governor off and said, okay, you can go for it. How far into the ride was that?
Yeah, so we had stepped the power up from up to the climb to Waimea, so we had gone just incrementally increasing, and that's where I sort of put some time into Rob and Peter, and then the descent from Waimea to Kawarahai, and that's essentially the governor was off from that intersection at where the Ironman goes from the Queen K at Kawarahai,
yep.
Turns left down the hill towards Harvey, so from there to the end, so it's probably, I think it was about 20 kilometres. They basically said, off you go, as hard as you want.
Yeah, and at that point, I think you built the lead to over 20 minutes. And we both know that in a double marathon, you get a little cramp or something, 20 minutes can go in a heartbeat.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, exactly. You still have to run really, really well and really consistently. If you have a bad run, you're looking at an hour, bleed time. So 20 minutes was a nice little buffer, but certainly we were still very cautious of making sure that I had to run my best run that I could.
And when you did Australia, I think you were a little limited in your training run-wise because you were dealing with some injuries. Did you feel this year that you were, your running fitness was better?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that going into this race and all this training, the goal was just not to get injured.
Right.
So I'd much rather be a little bit underdone with the mileage and just simply not be injured at the start line on day three, and we're super happy with that. I think I averaged, I don't think I ran much more than 50 mile a week. It was just, last year I was just too optimistic with regards to how many miles I thought my legs could handle and got really injured. So I was really happy going into day three. My legs felt good and I was ready to run the double marathon.
What hit me at the end of the bike ride, Rob Gray comes in and he's in second place for the day, and he's standing there looking at his computer, and he starts laughing. I'm like, what's going on? He goes, oh, my bike computer, it tells you that based on the workout you just did, how much time you should take off. And I said, "What? How much time? 4 days. In 12 hours, you're running a double marathon.
Double marathon. So good.
Yeah. So,
but what was interesting as well, the difficulty of that course, I rode more power to weight in Hawaii over that ride than I did in Australia, and it was an hour and a half longer on the bike.
Wow!
So we had to we didn't really know exactly how long that ride would be, but we definitely knew that it'd be longer than the ride in Australia. So that had to be we had to put that into the calculations as well. So to go from a 6.5 hour ride to an 8 hour ride is a big difference.
So during the double marathon, we're leapfrogging and getting splits. And I'm sure there was a point early on where you're thinking, I want to break this course record with this ridiculously long bike ride on day two. I think I can still get it. When did you decide, you know what, let's just finish this thing and get this thing over with?
At the end of day two, Bob.
Oh, you said no more. No, I'm not thinking about it.
Yeah, no. I think... Actually, the truth of that story is in October when I went and did the reconnaissance on the course,
yep.
I reported back to the crew. I said, we're not going for any sort of record now. I just thought there's just no possibility to try to work out how fast we could go because I just thought the terrain was just too demanding to be close to that time. What transpired was, and I think I needed a 6:26 at the end on day three to break that course record. And I think we were going for a 6:45, and that was essentially what we thought. Given the time in the extra time in the saddle on day two, we thought that was a good case scenario for us leading into day three. So at no point from October on was at no point were we ever looking at overall times. We were just trying to go for the win.
So did you know even before this, you started the journey in Hawaii on Friday, that this was going to be your last Ultraman, your second and last, and your first and last world championship, that you were going to retire afterwards?
Yep. That added the pressure when I was treading water in the
yeah. Yeah, when you're getting sick and you're going, this was supposed to be my last one, then you have to be going through your head, I can't go out like this. I've got to come back, which means I'm putting everybody through this all over again.
Through that again, yeah. I think, coming back into the sport as an athlete, the goal was always to see, I wanted that performance that truly represented who I was and what I could do as a sort of mid-30-year-old. I thought to myself and then said to the people around me, I said, if we can produce, I guess, the best effort that we can in Hawaii, then that'll absolutely be it for me. If we were left wondering or left searching or something didn't go wrong, something didn't go right significantly enough for me to go, that just doesn't represent me, I think I would be searching again and finding another race. But the way that it transpired, it wasn't the 6:45, it was a 6:55, and we sort of bled that 10 minutes just around that three-quarter mark. In the run, but other than that, it was a really, really, I felt that performance sort of best represented who I was or what I was able to do. More than finishing off the marathon, second marathon on day three, I was like, yeah, this is it for me for sure.
So now, as a retired endurance athlete, what will you be doing? Focusing on your coaching?
Yeah, I think so. I think that gives me the most, absolutely the most, I guess, joy in getting other athletes to achieve whatever they want to achieve and being part of that journey for them. And obviously helping our coaches that we have to inspire them and to help them to let their, so that they can sort of put that onto their athletes as well. But a lot of family time. And, I don't know, Bob. If you have any suggestions, I'm more than willing to consider them.
have you had some?
I guess,
yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, go on.
I was going to say, now that you've done two Ultraman races and won two Ultraman races, are you having some athletes come to you and go, hey, coach me for Ultraman?
Yeah, we do have a couple of Ultraman athletes or soon to be Ultraman athletes within the business, which is great to see, because I don't think it's a significant difference in training total volume. I think it obviously is athlete dependent and depending on their history, but it's more about how you structure that training within a week rather than this absurd volume that you need to sort of get your head around. I mean, I never thought I'd swim 6 miles. I think that's still a ridiculous distance to swim for anyone.
I couldn't agree more. And I love swimming. Swimming is my favorite thing, but I'm going... The 2.4 in Kona seemed like ridiculously long.
But I think I'm safe to say the triathlon for me as an athlete, that's it. But, you know, something like Ride Across America, a race across America, that sort of... pricks my interest a little bit, but not for a number of years. I think I need some time just to get a bit of clarity and spend some time, a bit more time with the athletes that I coach and get them to achieve their goals.
So for people out there who've done Ironman and they're thinking, okay, what's next? What is it about Ultraman that should appeal to them, that should push them to go, you know, I'd like to give one a try?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think The two things that stand out to me, or three things, let's go. One is the ridiculous distances and to be able to get your body through that. It does reinvigorate, I think, an athlete who may be a little bit sour or tired of the Ironman distance. You're no longer sort of getting pushed. I mean, there's time goals that you're still like, oh, this is getting a little bit old. Getting into a race where you're like, oh, this is really demanding. It's the idea of this is demanding, and probably initially everyone will push that away and go, nah, I can't. I don't want to do that. I don't think I can do that, rather. So breaking that race down into achievable parts and obviously achieving it. Secondly, is the crew environment. To have, select and get the right crew and race that, take that journey with them is so amazing. Something that, you know, I'm very, very, I feel very lucky to have experienced twice now. And thirdly, I think the most amazing thing about Ultraman is that recovery becomes such a crucial part of the whole jigsaw. So in an Ironman, you know, I remember you might go to the Kona roll down, right? And it's all based on who performed on that one day. So it doesn't, you might have somebody who misses out for a Hawaii spot who's walking up, you know, walking around fine. And then the person who has done a good, you know, has got a spot, he's like taking a wheelchair or hobbling up to the stage to get his spot because he's so, you know, they're so ruined from the race. But in Ultraman, you've got to be able to pace yourself, and recovery becomes, you know, how you recover between days is everything, because you need to turn up on day three almost fresh to run a double marathon. So you need to be able to get your body in a state so it can handle, 6 mile swim and 90 mile bike and 170 mile ride on day two, as if it's, you perform, but you're still holding back and you're still turning up on day three, feeling good about running 56 miles, and not feeling like the world's going to end.
You were the first person I've seen who actually had a bike trainer out there. And as soon as you're done with day one and day two, you're on the trainer. And which makes perfect sense, right? You either get in the cold ocean, and it's not a cold ocean, so you got to do something to get the lactic acid out of your legs. But everybody else was, you know, I'm sure getting ice or doing whatever. But how important was that? Because that was your fourth event or third event each day was, okay, the race part is over, and now I got to recover for tomorrow.
Correct. And yeah, that the wind trainer idea came from a couple of good friends down in Victoria, and it was something that I struggled with in Australia, especially on the end of day two. I was in a similar state as Rob was, you know, in the fetal position, crawling off my bike after day two back in Australia. And because as triathletes, we don't necessarily, or we very rarely ever go full gas and then stop straight away.
Right.
So we always, you know, either do some efforts in training and then warm down and then finish the ride and you feel good because you've warmed down, or we are riding controlled and then we run off the bike. So it's very rarely for you that you have the body to accept so much lactic acid in the, you know, and then stop immediately. So we had a look. I think that, you know, obviously it was inspired by, you know, the professional cycling teams where they will finish a really, really, you know, big mountain stage, and the person who's won the stage, or all of them, the top contenders,
all of them, yep,
all of them go to the buses and are immediately on a trainer to spin the legs out, and it only takes sort of 10 to 20 minutes to do that. But so we thought, why can't we do that? You know, somewhere in the shade and cool down. And that I felt that was amazing. I really did notice a huge difference just in doing that. So I hope to see that there'll be a few wind trainers out in Hawaii next year in November for sure.
Because, you know, it's interesting. I have seen people get a massage afterwards. And so I don't know, because your muscles are so beat up. Sometimes I just don't know how good that helps with recovery. And maybe, but I think the getting on the bike and spinning is definitely an essential. And really, I've been there for three years now, and you're the first person I've seen on a trainer.
Yeah, and I guess it is a matter of going, all right, so if we finish the stage at 1:30 p.m. And we have to start riding again at 6:30 a.m. the next morning, you know, we've got, you know, near on 18 hours. Almost 18, maybe 16 hours and to recover. And what in every minute or every 10 minutes, what are we doing? Everything was sort of, we had a plan in that time to properly recover. So it was the wind trainer. I was having, you know, protein and getting the carbs back in whilst I was on that bike. And then we'd go back to our condo and keep eating. Then I would get a massage once the body had really cooled down and sort of got tired after each day. I went and got a massage. Then I went for an active walk after dinner, and the dinners were, you know, we had an amazing person, a friend of ours come over from Australia who loves to cook. And so she came over and she was in charge of all meals for the weekend. So that was all there. And yeah, nice walk after dinner to sort of get the legs working again and then sleep. So everything was, and that's, again, this is the beauty of Ultraman. This is about, it's not just the three, you know, the three individual days of exercise, but it's essentially from when the gun goes to when you cross that finish line on day three, it's all the race.
The other thing is during the double marathon, and I remember last year when Rob Gray won, we're watching him and he runs the first 10 minutes and then he starts walking. And we're like, you know, he's got a lead. And this Arno Selikov is taking time out of him. And we're like, oh my God, he's walking 10 minutes in. But that was the plan. Yeah. He was going to run 10 and walk a minute, run 10 and walk a minute. And yours was what, 13, like 13 and a half and 90 seconds, something along that line?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I got that idea. I mean, I was, run walk is not a new idea, obviously, nope. But David Kalinowski, who won Australia in its inaugural year, in the same year went to Hawaii and got second behind Mike Coughlin. He did that. He did the run walk. I think he did 20 and 2. And so I'm friends with him, and I talked to him about that, and we worked out what the best formula was for me in terms of heart rate and decoupling, and how quickly the heart rate drops in between those intervals. And we, for Australia, we landed on 13.5, 1.5, and that worked well enough given my lack of running. And I touched base with Rob actually mid last year, just on the internet, and just said, "Look, good luck," because he lost. I think he lost that run, lost that race the year before on the run,
right?
To Inaki, and I sort of said, "Look, this is my experience, and you know, I definitely think the run walk is." And I think he had done that in Florida when he won, but he didn't do that in Hawaii. He had a lead into day three last year, and I remember touching base with him on day two night and said, "Look, you've got to do it. You know, you can't do it from Kauai High onward. You know, that drop down from Harvey to Kauai High is too much on your quads. You've got to give it some time." So it was amazing to see him implement that, and also amazing to see him win in such a tight battle,
right?
With Jeremy Howard, and who had a phenomenal run that year, 6:24, to come second. So yeah, we always thought 13.5, 1.5 was where I was at. We did run the first half an hour straight through, we'd trained for that as well. And but yeah, it was all on the first marathon went to plan, and yeah, as I said, in that third half marathon, my legs got ITB got quite sore, and had to go through a few painkillers, but we managed okay.
You managed okay, yeah. So from your, because you're sort of a human guinea pig, right? As a coach, you take away from what you learn training yourself for your athletes. What have you taken from your racing that's worked for other athletes, or you know, something that you learn when light bulb goes on, you're going, oh my God, I didn't know that. That's helped other athletes.
Yeah, I don't have any silver bullets, unfortunately. I think there's a lot of really good coaches out there, and generally who do really well, you know, do great things for their athletes. I think in my experience, the number one, two important facets of success as an athlete is, I think you need to have a really good support network. It's really difficult to do well and consistently well in the sport if the support network around you is less than ideal. And then secondly, I think it's purely the relationship between athlete and coach and how strong that is. You'll find, I think, that the athletes that do very well from you know, the professionals all the way to the 17-hour athletes, you know, the result, the improvements that an athlete will get through their life will be significantly more if the relationship or if that working relationship between athlete and coach is really strong. And sometimes, I think sometimes personalities don't mix, and then you sort of have to go, well, we're not suited as an athlete and coach. But I think they're the main two for sure. In terms of technical stuff with Ultraman, at the end of the day, I think the theory is, and it has always been for me, or get to that second marathon, get to the 42 or the 26-mile mark fresh.
Yeah, that's when the racing starts, that last mile, last marathon, yeah.
Yeah, and who wants to race that last marathon feeling like, you know, that your race is over or you have to walk in the last 26 miles? You want to feel on top of the world, right, and feel like you've still got some fight in you. So get to that point fresh, and then you can anyone can battle through a marathon feeling good or feeling fresh from the start. And then you work backwards from there and you get to the start of the 6.2-mile swim.
So this is a world championship, right? And back in the 80s, when Ironman was a world championship in 1985, it was the last year where they didn't have prize money. 86, they started doing prize money. And if Ultraman was to go to prize money, how do you think that would change? Would it ruin the event, or would it enhance the event? What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know whether... I think it's a good question, Bob. I think it's great to have events like these that don't attract too many professionals. I know that there's been a few professionals come through and they've had a good go at it and obviously do very well compared to the average age grouper. It'd be nice to see maybe a different race or a league or a series to see. Put some money in to that distance to see how quick a professional, you know, someone who does this full time without a job, or that is their job, I guess, to see how quick they can go through, you know, those distances. Because I think it'd be significantly faster, lots faster than whatever I could dream of. To see, you know, the likes of, you know, the top end guys in Ironman, to see what they could do for a double on relatively, you know, fresh legs without a ride straight up before it. That would be cool. That'd be really cool to see.
That would be a lot of fun.
But yeah, right. And yeah, I can only imagine what, you know,
Patrick Lange.
Patrick could What Patrick could run a cold double marathon in would be phenomenal.
I know. It would be pretty fun to watch. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know whether his coach would ever allow that. Probably not. But,
no.
It'd be fun. It's fun to think. But for the time being, the race does certainly feel, not that I was obviously there, but it definitely feels like the 80s where Ironman was in the early 80s.
No question.
Even though the sport's been around, I guess.
No, it's very special. The whole Ohana is not just a word. It's true. It's everybody's crew is out helping each other. You got, you know, fast guys, and you could be the fastest, and you're a perfect example. You could be the fastest guy out there, but if your crew is fighting with each other and is out to lunch when you get a flat tire, your race is done. You got to have the best crew there is. It's all about that camaraderie and everybody getting along and working together.
And even on the run, you know, I had a Spanish guy, one of the guys from Spain, a really good runner. He was running next to me, and his crew was maybe a mile up the road waiting for him. And my crew had just given me some water, and I drank that and then gave him, he was running next to me, and I gave him some water, and he was like, oh, gracias, you know. And
yeah.
It's just, and then I think he repaid the favor maybe, you know, an hour later.
Right.
When he had some extra water. So it definitely has that amazing, you know, that really nice feel to it, which is a credit to the organizers and obviously the people that started the sport.
Absolutely. Hey, Richard, congratulations. It's not often that somebody can retire as the undefeated world champion.
Yeah, right? Sorry, but I think I'll take it with a grain of salt, but it's been a nice, a very nice experience to go through, especially with the family and the crew, and maybe lawn bowls or just watching the football is my personal pastime now.
Love it. Richard Thompson has been our guest again. This is Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by Tough Man Triathlon Series, by VeloFix.com, by Polar Blood, Sweat, and Data, Premium Plus Sports, our official travel agency, USA-SwimRun.com, our Challenged Athletes Foundation. We've now raised over $100 million in our first 25 years to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on Babbittville on iTunes. And until next time, remember, endurance lives here.